Laura Kelly has written a book called The Silk Road Gourmet. I should add, however, that we're looking only at volume one of it, and there are going to be two more volumes. Laura, welcome to the show. I don't know where you find the time to do a three-volume piece.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Tell our listeners the scope of your book. Volume one encompasses what?
Volume one is Western and Southern Asia, and it runs from the Republic of Georgia to Sri Lanka. And I try to look at the patterns of foods that are in the commonalities between countries, and then connect those commonalities in the food with historical events, whether they're trade or economic relationships or shared religion or empire.
So you're in fact suggesting that there was an anthropological basis and a geographical basis for the similarities in the cuisine along the way.
Absolutely.
Of course.
In fact, some of it was quite purposeful. When you have, this is a topic that will be covered in Volume 2, but you had Timur, when he was building his great Uzbek kingdom, he was purposely bringing in the greatest artisans from all over his kingdom to try to bolster the international reputation of his city. And these were the greatest thinkers, and they were bringing their cultures with them, including their food.
Well, so what about Peter the Great? I mean, you know, Peter the Great,
yeah,
didn't he do the same thing?
But he wasn't exactly on the Silk Road. I mean, the Silk Road was Silk Road was a sort of bigger thing because it extended over several centuries, and trade went both ways, right?
Yes. In fact, the roots of the Silk Road go back as far as 4,000 years ago or more, 4,000 BC, actually. There's an episodic trade of the lapis lazuli and jade between Afghanistan and China.
Huh, lapis, huh?
Huh?
Lapis, great.
Yes, the Afghanis have great lapis, in fact.
Oh, wonderful.
And the Chinese have great jade. And that's where it all started. And interestingly, in our history books, we only consider a small portion of the Silk Road, that is the Central Asian overland route from China to Europe, when in fact there were many, many land routes and also sea routes that connected the world from Europe to China and the Philippines and Indonesia, Thailand, India, down to Mogadishu, in fact, even in Africa. So, the North African area of the Mediterranean was included. So you have this incredible engine of commerce that's moving cultures and ideas around, and it's really quite remarkable to
What gave you the idea to do this ambitious project of three-volume Silk Road Gourmet book?
Well, from a taste point of view, I found that it was kind of difficult to come up with really authentic recipes in the United States sometimes, that a lot of them had been toned down or adapted because ingredients used to be difficult to get. But with the internet, a lot of ingredients have become available. You can mail order everything from lemongrass to holy basil these days, or if you're lucky enough to have a market.
Now, you were talking about the availability of ingredients and so on.
Right.
But what drives the market? I mean, why did you think that this was something you needed to write?
It's also to get the authentic flavors out there and to show people that, you know, a lot of ingredients had been edited out, when olive oil put in, for instance, for light sesame oil, or chilies, the amount of chilies toned down to the point where it hardly resembles the authentic dish. So it was a part of the idea to get an authentic book out there, to update some other concepts to the 21st century now that we have internet commerce. And lastly, it was to give myself a creative expression from my day job.
Is there a family connection? Is there a...
I come from
this particular region?
Foodies.
Yes, you do.
Every Italian family is a family of foodies.
Oh, okay, so you're not from Georgia or Armenia or any of the places along the road.
But I did grow up in the kitchen, because that's just what...
Absolutely.
I know that, too. I actually had a really interesting conversation. Lydia Bastianich wrote that Italian-American cookbook. I don't know if you ever saw it.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a conversation with her, and she was able to tell me the exact ingredients that were absolutely substituted by Italian Americans for the real stuff. I mean, what the real stuff was in Italy.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing.
Well, of course you would be. I mean, that was their area of study. I mean, that's I guess she made herself an expert on it, even if she wasn't.
Well, I mean, but she's
Just like Laura made herself an expert on the countries along the Silk Road.
Yeah. by traveling through them.
So you were traveling there for other reasons besides...
Working in public health or for other employers.
So, and you cook these recipes too?
Yes. I've been cooking since I've been about 13. Part of that is family, and part of that is just my mother used to throw these wonderful international parties in the backyard, and this is back in the 70s and things like that, when it was really hard to do this, like an Indonesian night or something, with torches and all sorts of food. And I grew up like that. My sister actually became a professional chef and used to direct the Morrison Clark Inn down here in D.C., as well as working on the line for Daniel Boulot. And she started as entremetier and wound up as poissonnière at the original Daniel's before she went on for greener pastures.
We know that restaurant very well. Which of these in Volume 1 recipes were you really surprised to discover a variation on what people were expecting? Or have things people were cooking, and in fact they were far removed from the original recipe? Which
I would probably say that some of the biggest surprises were actually in the Georgian and Armenian recipes, that there was a lot of toning down that was being done to the spices. Georgians like their food fairly spicy, or rather what they do what many Asian cuisines strive for is a variety of different flavors, sweet, salty, hot, you know, that sort of thing. So they'll have this incredible pepper sauce named adjika that they put on meat, and then they'll put a semi-sweet pomegranate and sweet basil sauce on it.
Wow, I never. So
it's a really complex. It winds up being a very complex dish with you know, a wide variety of flavors as it moves through the mouth. So it's I think that was probably some of the biggest surprises, is how flavorful the Caucasian and Caspian food was.
Well, it'd be interesting. We went to a Georgian banquet in Pittsburgh, given by a friend who had just traveled there and came back. And the thing I remember most about it was everybody drinking themselves into a coma.
Yeah. Well, I guess they do that. I guess they do that too.
Well, I just went to a wine tasting at the embassy here in D.C.
Uh-huh.
And that was really fantastic. They had
from Georgia.
Yes.
Wow.
They had several different vintners there, and vineyards represented, and so you could walk through and taste a traditional wine that's done in the beeswax-lined clay amphora in the ground.
Yeah, we visited a winery in...
In fact, he's buying his amphoras from Georgia.
From Georgia, which I thought was an odd...
He's a winemaker on the...
Grafner.
On the border of...
Friuli
of Italy, Friuli, Venezia Giulia, and I always forget the name of the country that's on the other side. Slovenia, I think. So, but he found out about this practice.
He buries them in the ground. I mean, he tore up.
I'm sure they do the same thing.
Yeah. Georgians do exactly the same thing, in fact, and they stir it with these long wooden rods and just so, and it's really quite a remarkable process. And then you could walk to the other side of the room and have the vineyards who were going at the same wine, same grapes, with a more modern process. So you really got a sense of how it had evolved from traditional wines to today. So
well, that's interesting.
Talk to us a little bit about the food in Afghanistan. It seems to be in the news right now, and food is not one of the things it's in the news for.
Well, Afghanistan is really a special case. It's very interesting because it was a real crossroads between East and West throughout its history, and it's been almost ruled, is what I'll say, by a lot of different cultures.
Oh, everybody's been there, yeah.
But nobody's ever really ruled it.
Correct. Yeah. Nobody's ever really. There's always been revolt that's fomenting in the mountains.
That's like Sicily.
Meanwhile, all of this political change has left a large cultural marks on Afghani cooking. So it's really quite remarkable. You'll get some very, very Western type spices in there, like thyme and basil, even though that's really, and it's some from the Indian subcontinent. And then you'll get some real Eastern flavors coming in. So it's quite interesting. And there's all sorts of surprises, like they have these tamarind ginger potatoes.
That sounds great.
Would really go good, really go, we eat them here, matched with a great steak or a lamb chop or something like that. So you don't have to just experience the food in the Silk Road Gourmet, just as saying we're going to eat Afghani tonight, you could incorporate the recipes more globalized presentation.
And all these ingredients are readily available, right?
But now they are, yes.
Yeah.
And our area, we live in sort of the Baltimore, D.C. corridor, mm-hmm. and we have a Persian market nearby, we have an Indian market nearby, and we also have an East Asian market. So I'm within a half an hour of almost anything. And there's some rarer things, like some Caucasian ingredients that I can get through the mail seasonally.
Tell me about Mongolia.
When you say Caucasian, in this case, you're talking... You're talking Georgia in the Caucasus.
Georgia and Armenia. Yes.
You're not talking about white Americans.
No. I can get some Georgian and Armenian things, rarer things that are harder to get, like Janjoli or the fresh sour plums. You can get the dried sour plums in a lot of different markets, but to get them fresh, that's still a little bit hard to come by, or fresh sour cherries. You can mail away for those.
Now, our nephew just married a Mongolian. And I saw some photographs that they took when they were on their honeymoon there in Mongolia.
Mm-hmm.
And the food did not look very appetizing. The one arresting image was of the head of a goat floating in a pot of stew.
Like a Rolling Stones cover from the 60s.
I guess. Now, how would you suggest that readers would use the Silk Road Gourmet in their daily cooking? Is it something for special occasions, or you want people buy into the whole thing?
I think it's something to be enjoyed every day. How people should use this, I have two suggestions. If you let's say you know you like beets, or you know you like lamb chops or something like that, go for some of the flavor combinations that seem a little foreign. That's one way to incorporate it into daily life. A lot of the recipes, if you have a basic familiarity with the ingredients and have the ingredients on hand, are 15 to 20 minutes, maybe a half an hour, really, really quite quick. I'm a working mom, and I cook this. So I cook it after a long, coming home from a long day of work. So it's doable that way. Another way you could go about it, and something I like to do a lot, is tastings, where you'll all get together and between five or six friends, you'll cook an Ajiri meal, each one of you bringing one thing. Or you can, say, take all of the stuffed peppers from Georgia to Sri Lanka or something like that, or stuffed vegetables, and bring them and try them, and then talk about the flavors and talk about how one is different from the other. And it's more of a master class, I suppose, approach to using the book.
Well, I'll tell you, listeners, there are some exciting things that you would never have thought about in here, such as lamb and rhubarb stew, mm-hmm. baked fish with pomegranates and oranges. I mean, this is exciting stuff. So,
a lot of meat and fruit combinations.
Yeah, I'd like to try it. Well, anyhow, Laura, keep us posted.
Okay.
And great talking to you.
Yeah, we'll talk to you next year about Volume 2.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me.
Thanks, Laura.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. Well, that wraps it again for another week, and I'm going to say until next week.
Same time, same place.
Bye-bye.